In the early 1980s, at the height of the Cold War, the state legislatures of California and Arkansas, and ultimately the House of Representatives of the United States, demonstrated consummate bravery by taking on the ultimate enemy, Satan and his avenue to the innocent minds of American youth, Led Zeppelin. The 1983 California bill was meant to address recordings that might manipulate our behavior without our knowledge or consent and turn us into disciples of the Antichrist. This was a very serious matter indeed, perhaps the most serious, and Arkansas unanimously approved a similar bill. Of concern, for those concerned, the young governor of the state, Bill Clinton, vetoed the bill, and the state house was unable to overcome the veto. A similar bill was introduced by Republican Representative Bob Dornan of California to the United States House of Representatives, but in what must have seemed a victory for the devil himself, the bill never made it out of subcommittee. These legislators had become concerned that certain record albums, when played backwards, contained satanic messages. Songs that contained hidden messages when played backwards were said to exhibit backward masking, or simply backmasking. The most famous example being Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven and its line, already pretty abstruse, "If there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alarmed now," that, when played backwards, said, the concern claimed, "Here's to my sweet Satan." California, true to form, attempted to require the following label on records: "Warning, this record contains backward masking, which may be perceptible at a subliminal level when the record is played forward." In the end, Satan was defeated, not by legislation, but by the invention of the compact disc player, which did not allow backwards play. I'm Josh Young, and this is Playing Odd, a podcast about complexity and information in the natural world. Episode 5, Non-Determinism. Questions of Jimmy Page's lucidity aside, is it possible to create lyrics that convey a message in either direction? Would such a feature so constrain the sort of message that could be produced that it would compromise the amount of information that the message would convey? Put another way, could we get twice as much information from our genome if we read it forward and backward? Words that can be read forward and backward with the same result are, of course, called palindromes. We are absolutely not talking about palindromic DNA, because for such genes, amusing as they might be, the reverse direction would carry identical information to the forward direction. The linguistic term for what we seek are called subordinalaps, a clever play on the word palindrome. Examples of palindromes are words like race car and level that carry the same information content in either direction. Examples of subordinalaps include desserts, which can be read backwards as stressed, and diaper, which can be read backwards as repaid. Are there any genes that are subordinalaps? To answer this question, we need to look at an organism with a highly compacted genome. In contrast to the 2% encoding portion versus 98% non-encoding portion of our genome, yeast, specifically Saccharomyces cerevisiae, has a genome in which 85% is encoding and only 15% is non-encoding. This focus on minimizing the size and therefore maximizing the efficiency of the yeast genome must be the result of some adaptive pressure. The outcome has been the development of a genome that is ultra-compressed. Let's learn a bit of jargon here. Nucleotide base pairs, the byte equivalent of the genome, are read in groups of three referred to as codons. There are enough permutations of three nucleotides, each of which can be one of four possibilities, to provide unique codes for each of the 20 amino acids from which our proteins are composed. Just like human language, these codons are read in a particular direction. The direction in which they are read is referred to by geneticists as the sense direction. The opposite direction, in which backmasking might occur, is referred to as the antisense direction. Mutations or other disruptions that result in undecipherable combinations of nucleotides are referred to as nonsense, and errors or omissions that cause codons to be read as encoding the wrong amino acid are referred to as missense. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, like all organisms, interprets its genome in the sense direction, but amazingly, also does some of its decoding in the antisense direction. That means that there are some parts of the genome that are read both in the forward direction and in the backward direction, and contain different information depending upon in which direction they are read. However, the degree of backcoding present in this yeast is very limited and does not include any actual genes. The information that is gathered through antisense reading plays a role in what we called conditional statements or regulation of gene expression rather than including the creation of a novel protein. The result is that some additional information may indeed be backmasked in the yeast genome, but the actual amount of information is very, very small. Even if such backcoding existed in the human genome, the amount of additional information it would represent would be far too trivial to help us in our construction of the complex synaptic network of the brain. Remember, dear listener, in our last episode, we explored the information density of noise. We understood that this noise is not always helpful in conveying information we want to convey, but we did recognize that it is a rich source of information nonetheless. Might we introduce some degree of randomness into the genome itself in order to garner more information? And what would this randomness look like? Let's revisit the imperfect analogy of the genome as a book. How could we introduce randomness into a book? One thing we might consider doing is randomizing the order of sentences. If we were to completely randomize everything, we would be likely to wind up with unintelligible text. However, what if this randomization were limited? What if the mixing of sentences were constrained but still random in nature? This sort of shuffling occurs in organisms, and the portions of the genome that are shuffled are referred to as transposable elements, or colloquially as jumping genes. This is a bit of a misnomer because it is not an entire gene encoding for an entire protein that is typically shuffled, but rather a shorter bit of genetic code. Barbara McClintock won the Nobel Prize in 1985 for her discovery of these transposable elements. Shuffling sentences, or more accurately, parts of sentences, within an essay will produce novel combinations, but very few of these combinations will make sense. Some sentences will be turned into nonsense, and if enough shuffling takes place, the essay itself will become incoherent. For this reason, cells have developed defense mechanisms to prevent the movement of these transposable elements. But like all defense mechanisms, the degree of prevention, the degree of mitigation, is less than complete. Thus, new information is introduced into the genome by the mechanism of transposition, but like noise in our audio recording, this new information is generally not beneficial to the organism. Transposable elements are implicated in disease like hemophilia and cancer, and likely play a role in the introduction of mutations that are the stuff on which evolution is built. But at the level of an individual organism, at the level of neurodevelopment, transposable elements are not the answer for which we are looking. Have we reached a niche in our discussion of what would later become called transposons? Is this something so obscure as to not really matter? Far from it. Although only 2% of our genome constitutes protein-encoding genes, DNA transposons constitute 3%, or 1.5 times as much of our genome as the genes themselves. Other transposable elements represent more than 40% of our genome, and some of these are remnants of retroviruses. A retrovirus, like all viruses, originates outside of the organism or the cell that it infects. Unlike other viruses, retroviruses are translated from RNA into DNA, this being opposite to the pathway of typical protein construction. And this newly translated DNA is incorporated into the organism's genome itself. some of these retroviruses produce frank pathology, like HIV. Other retroviruses seem to have lost their pathological potential and reside as fragments in our own genome. As parts of the genome, these retroviral fragments are passed on to future generations, and it is difficult to say which of our ancestors in our evolutionary tree acquired the original retrovirus. These endogenous retroviruses may represent as much as half of our genome, and certainly represent many, many times the amount of our genome that's actually devoted to encoding proteins. Like ambitious reporters competing for column space in a newspaper, the parties competing for space in the genome include not only transposable elements, genetic expression control sequences, and endogenous retroviruses, but also aggressive genes as well. These selfish genes, a term coined by Richard Dawkins, or parasitic DNA, enhance their own replication within the genome, and in some cases, interfere with expression of less aggressive genes. Richard Dawkins, in The Selfish Gene, advocates for the idea of the gene and not the organism as the unit of evolution. He proposes that competition between genes is the real basis of evolution and that organisms are merely vessels for the genes. But you and I can propose an alternative view, having digested the perspective of Benoit Mandelbrot. Evolution is itself fractal. It occurs on many levels and in many scales. Selection and evolution can occur at the level of the gene, at the level of the organism, or even at the level of the hive, and one is not exclusive of the others. Evolution is like our snowflake that describes a similar pattern over a wide range of scales. We've seen that in this context, although adding a random element provides a new information source, this information has not furthered our project of producing a brain. Should we discard randomness as unhelpful noise, as was done in the time before Claude Shannon? Let's examine an instance in which randomness has provided unequivocal value. In the early days of artificial intelligence, two important schools competed. Advocates of symbolic AI, represented by Marvin Minsky, who asserted that intelligence arose from the manipulation of abstract symbols representing concepts and relationships, and advocates of neural networks, represented by George Hinton, who saw reinforceable connections as the key to AI. Minsky's criticisms of the connectionist school was that early neural networks performed poorly and were not robust to changes in the sort of problems with which they were presented. The algorithms worked only in particular circumstances and demonstrated themselves to be fragile. In part because of Minsky's criticism, interest in and funding for neural networks greatly diminished in what became known as the AI winter. Since we are accustomed to image recognition software that is based on algorithms derived from these neural networks, we have to ask, what changed? Why do neural networks perform so nicely now? The key to this improved performance was the introduction of random elements into the neural network algorithm. I'm going to give an analogy to the classic problem of gradient descent, but before I do so, I want to ask the forgiveness of my many AI colleagues for the gross simplification I'm about to construct. Let's imagine ourselves as surveyors who wish to plan a hiking path from the peak of a mountain to its base. This path laying from a highest point to a lowest point is analogous to many of the mathematical challenges we encounter in developing AI algorithms. Let's further complicate things by imagining that we are doing this in complete darkness and with no knowledge of the topography of the landscape. Our strategy involves placing a hapless hiker at the peak of this mountain and asking him to find his way down. The path he plots will be what will eventually become the hiking path for visitors to the mountain. What strategy should the hiker take in order to move from the top of the mountain to the bottom? This sounds like such an easy question as to pose no real challenge. The hiker should simply walk in the direction that he recognizes is down. Problem solved, right? Well, not so fast. Real mountains do not have continuous slopes from their top to their bottom, but rather describe an irregular shape that incorporates many crevasses and excavations. How might this prove problematic to our strategy? Let's say that the hiker's stride is 1 meter. That is to say, when the hiker moves, each foot steps 1 meter in front of the other foot. The hiker is instructed to go in the direction that is down. Keep in mind that this is in complete darkness and the hiker cannot see where he is going. The hiker makes good progress moving downward from the peak and then, without knowing what he is doing, walks into a shallow crater of 3 meters diameter. He continues his descent to the bottom of the crater, but then, regardless of the direction in which he moves, he finds himself to be ascending as he moves up the wall of the crater. He therefore concludes that he has reached the bottom of the mountain and his job is done. Wherein lies his mistake? It is that he has not reached the absolute nadir of the landscape, but rather he has found himself in a little localized dip. In computer science, we call this a local minimum. But employing the strategy of always walking down, the hiker has no knowledge that the base of the mountain lies far below. This problem has arisen because of the relation between the length of his stride and the width of the crater. Certainly, the hiker would not have gotten stuck in this local minimum had his stride been longer or perhaps shorter than 1 meter. Might we have had more success by choosing a hiker with a 2 meter stride? Probably not. It's true that this hiker might not have gotten stuck in the particular 3 meter crater, but he's likely to have found his way into a different size crater that posed the same problem and convinced him that this local minimum was in fact the base of the mountain. The solution, counterintuitively, is to employ a hiker with a random stride. Since his stride length is always changing and in an unpredictable fashion, he will eventually find his way out of almost any crater in which he lands. He is far more likely to chart a path from the top of the mountain to the bottom. We have solved this gradient descent problem by introducing a random element. This element carried additional information that would have been absent had the stride length been fixed. A fixed algorithm, as we've seen, is what we call deterministic, in the sense that we can predict the outcome with certainty. An algorithm that incorporates a random element is said to be stochastic, in that we may understand the general outcome, but we are unable to predict with precision what the final product, what the final algorithm will be. We can make statistical predictions, but stochastic algorithms are, by their nature, non-deterministic. Although counterintuitive when compared to our usual understanding of the world, the introduction of stochastic elements not only helps us to solve problems, but also encourages us to view the world in probabilistic terms. On the other hand, we seem to have now found ourselves in a different sort of local minimum. We seem to have pulled out all the stops with genetic data compression in order to produce the massive connectome of the brain. We've used compression and the introduction of conditional statements. We've looked at reading the genome both forward and backward and have incorporated stochastic elements in the form of transposons. And yet we find ourselves little further in our path to building a brain than we had in episode one. Let me make the case more clear. What if the genome were amenable to perfect compression? What if every single base pair represented information about a single synapse? What if the entire 770 megabytes of genetic information were devoted to brain architecture, even in this physically impossible hypothetical, we would still be nowhere near an instruction set to build a functioning brain. Does our story end here? Or have we found ourselves in a little crater on a hillside that leads much, much further down? Perhaps it's time to randomize our own stride, and we will do this not by turning to Markram or Minsky or Mandelbrot, but to weather and to chaos itself. And this is where we will pick up the story next week. In this episode, we took great pains to compress as much information as possible into the genome. We talked about backcoding, that is to say, antisense reading of parts of the genome, and of introducing randomness as an additional information source. We met Marvin Minsky, who, though an early critic of neural networks, is a giant in the field of complexity, and we will look forward to meeting him again later. But we saw, for all our efforts, that interpreting the genome as an instruction set, even if it were maximally compressed, is inadequate by many orders of magnitude to produce the level of complexity represented by the human brain. We decided that a new approach is needed, one that will incorporate stochastic elements, but one that will take a different view of how information is employed to build us. I want to thank you, kind listener, for taking this journey through complexity with me. A bibliography for this episode, along with links to additional material, can be found at playingodd.com. I hope this program will serve as an opening to a broader conversation. Please write to me with your questions or comments at josh@playingodd.com. Looking forward to spending time with you next week. I'm Josh Young.